ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Norman, we talk a lot about the gut microbiome. What do you do to nurture your gut bugs?
What do I do to nurture? Well, I talk to it regularly. I have a sort of communication.
There is a big, strong brain-gut interaction.
Well, There is this crosstalk. I'm really into crosstalk at the moment. So your muscles talk to your brain, your muscles talk to your gut and your microbiome, and your microbiome talks to your brain.
Yes.
So, I feel that it might get a bit lonely just talking to me, so I talk back to it. Now, so what I do think about it occasionally. So I try and have fresh yogurt once every day or two. I try and eat lots of vegetables and not too much red meat, and plenty of extra virgin olive oil. How does that, you've written books on this stuff, Priya, how does that go?
That sounds good to me. I just think of eating the rainbow. All the diverse fruit and veggies, whole grains. I try and limit artificial sweeteners, but we're learning so much more about the bugs in your gut, the impact it can have on your health. And this week we have a story on Indigenous infants, their gut microbiome, and the fact that it's far more diverse with different organisms in it. What does it all mean? And does it potentially mean an earlier, healthier start in life?
And it's probably a window into First Nations history in Australia. It's a really interesting study.
That's coming up on The Health Report. I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, up to 30% of Australian adults could be living with fatty liver disease. And while prevention is important, what should you do if you already have the diagnosis?
There are early warning signs emerging when it comes to Australia's target of eliminating cervical cancer. And the answer to why there is an issue could be in our schools.
In the news, the GP and preventative health buff in me is devastated by the news that Vic Health, or people might know it as the Victorian Health Promotion Foundation. It's been around since 1987. They are a foundation who've done heaps of work in promoting good health and also taking on big industries like the tobacco industry to really bring about significant reform. But they're shutting their doors and they're being resorbed into the Department of Health in Victoria.
And just a little bit of history here. This was started, if I'm correct in my memory, by a Conservative government in Victoria and coincided with the introduction of a tobacco legislation,
yes,
which introduced a tobacco tax. This was the innovation, and it was a world-first innovation, where they used the income from the tobacco tax to fund prevention. And their early projects were associated with buying out unhealthy advertising. So you had alcohol advertising, you had tobacco advertising. This is before the bans on advertising. So the foundation bought that out and didn't require any government money. It was self-funding and did enormous work there. And then a little bit later, tobacco advertising was banned and so on. But the Treasury Department in Victoria hated the idea of Vic Health from the start because they hate hypothecation. So if they're taxing something, they hate the idea that that taxation goes to a specific project. And so there's a long history actually in Victoria of the Department of Health and indeed the government in general not really liking the Victorian Health Promotion Foundation because it's independent. And its independence allowed it to move around in the prevention space with much more flexibility than any government department is able to.
And I think the independence of Vic Health, and this is an organisation that I constantly use the resources of in the consulting room. They do wonderful work for early cancer screening, prevention space for skin cancer. They take on really commercially vested big food and beverage marketing, tobacco, gambling, alcohol. And it's because they're independent, Norman, that they're able to do that. And the real fear here is that now they're being absorbed into the Department of Health, where we know that there are lobbyists in all sorts of, at all levels of government. Will they be able to continue this good work?
But here's Rob Moody, Professor of Public Health at Melbourne School of Population and Global Health. He was Chief Executive of Vic Health from 1998 till 2007. And the other day he spoke to Fran Kelly on the Radio National Hour.
You cannot have the industries around the table when you're making policy, and we do. And that's why you need outside agencies like a Vic Health to be researching this, to be looking at what's going on, to be looking at where the political donations are going, to be looking at where the revolving door happens, to look at where these large corporations that have huge resources are influencing government policy in a very unhealthy way.
So let's hope that the Victorian Department of Health reconsider. The five previous chairs, including a previous federal health minister, Nicola Roxon, have written to the Victorian state government pleading for its survival.
And I would say this is the time to pour money into prevention. We talk on this show about mental health crisis and rates of chronic disease going up. This is the time when we should be pumping and pouring into prevention, not ripping the guts out of it as we are. So, yes, let's watch this space and hope that the pressure leads to some action.
While we don't want to keep on focusing on the United States, some of the things that happen there can leak here. And the new advisory committee on immunization practices, which is kind of the equivalent of our ATAGI, had a meeting last week. You might have seen the news on it. And in fact, Donald Trump has commented on it as well. One of the things that they've changed or want to change, the decision's got to be implemented, is to stop the birth dose of the hepatitis B vaccine. And this has enormous implications. The United States had thousands of cases of children with hepatitis B before this vaccine was introduced. Children who develop hepatitis B get it worse, it lasts longer, is more likely to cause cancer and liver failure. And you cannot rely on family history, ethnicity, anything really, to totally avoid the risk of acquiring hepatitis B at birth. And there's no harm to the vaccine if, in fact, you're not at risk of hepatitis B. We're giving vaccines all the time to children who may not be at particular risk, but we do that for prevention of the community as a whole. And they're talking about introducing it at the age of 12. I mean, it's just a disaster for America.
And it puts them in the minority because the WHO has 194 member states and 116 of them still recommend a universal birth dose of hepatitis B. But Norman, this is the same committee, I think it's worth reminding everybody, the same committee that RFK Jr. fired all 17 sitting members in June of this year in an unprecedented move. And now we've got members like Robert Malone, who has certainly spread misinformation and conspiracy theories when it comes to vaccinations. These are the people who are delivering this advice. And they're basically saying, look, we no longer need to give it universally to infants in the US, and they're going to only give it to the infants of mothers whose hepatitis B status is not known, or if they do have confirmed hepatitis B. And that might sound good on paper or to people listening, but you cannot rely on testing alone to prevent this serious chronic potential liver condition, because people's hepatitis B status can change. They might acquire it after they're tested. And not everyone is tested in pregnancy. There are plenty of patients who do not have antenatal testing. So these infants are at serious risk. You cannot just rely on testing serology or blood only.
So be glad that you're having babies in Australia.
Yes, but I think you did point out that this does have flow-on effects here at home. And I think watching this advisory panel meet was really quite disconcerting, because when they talked about safety, they plant seeds of doubt. And one of the things they say is there's never been a randomised controlled trial for the hepatitis B vaccine. And Norman, I know it's the US, but people then come into the consulting room and go, well, Priya, I just heard there's no randomised controlled trial for this vaccine you're about to give my child. Randomised controlled trials are amazing, but they're not the only way that we can gather scientific information and test efficacy of vaccines. And there are other epidemiological tools that we have to do that. And it's often unethical to do a randomised controlled trial with vaccines when you know that they're going to work. And you say to a group of infants, we're not going to give it to you, but we're only going to give it to these ones. You simply can't do it because it's unethical. So it's just these seeds of doubt, Norman, that just have far-reaching consequences and tend to have an impact here at home.
And you don't want your child growing up with hepatitis B. You don't want to condemn them to that, because it's condemned them to a fairly miserable life if it develops. And liver cancer rates are already rising rapidly in Australia, even with hepatitis B vaccination early in life, and that would just rocket even further if we didn't do it.
So it's unsettling times, but we're all together in this, I think, on the Health Report on ABC Radio National. I reckon people hear a lot about fatty liver in the prevention field, and a lot of people have fatty liver and go, well, what am I meant to do when I have the diagnosis now?
So this is the whole relationship with obesity and overweight.
and metabolic syndrome and lots of other things.
Just before you go on, we've had a story on the Health Report suggesting that we underdiagnose it because of the way pathology companies report on liver function tests.
I was trying to get to exactly.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
I was going to test
I'll shut up
memory.
From now on. You go on.
I was going to say, do you remember the story you did? Because
no, I don't remember that story. Tell me about it.
Well, you might have a normal liver function panel on your blood test. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything is okay, and you may well have fatty liver. So for anyone who is pondering, do I have it? Do I need a scan? I've got fatty liver. What am I meant to be doing? This is for you with some practical takeaways. I spoke to Professor James O'Byrne, who's a consultant hepatologist at Sunshine Coast University Hospital in Queensland.
Fatty liver disease, the term was first coined in the sort of late 70s, early 80s. It was originally termed non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So we've known that people who drink too much alcohol can get deposits of fat in their liver. But back in the 80s, people noticed that sometimes people who were overweight or diabetic were getting fat in their liver and it wasn't related to alcohol. So then it was termed non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And that name stuck for a while, but people worried that it was a disease that was defined by what it wasn't rather than what it was. So there was a move to change the terminology. And certainly in America and Europe, they've gone for the term of metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, and steatosis being the medical word for fat. Whereas in Australia and the eastern side of the hemisphere, we've retained the metabolic dysfunction associated fatty liver disease, which I think is a bit easier to understand for many people.
So what causes it then? Is it lifestyle? Is it genetic?
It's a bit of both, actually. I mean, it's normal to have some fat in your liver. So about 5% of your liver cells will have tiny droplets of fat in them. And that's normal because metabolism of fat is something that the liver does. But if you're overweight, if you have a certain mutation in a gene, and certainly if you're diabetic, that fat can start to increase in the liver and more of the liver cells become laden with these little droplets of fat. And that doesn't really affect the liver function much. It might cause the liver test to be elevated when your GP checks them. But the worry is the longer that goes on over many years, that fat can cause some inflammation. And as the liver tries to heal the inflammation, it lays down scar tissue, which over time begins to link up. And that's when people develop cirrhosis and all the complications that can go with that. It's not true that everybody with fatty liver is going to develop cirrhosis. It's actually a minority of those people. And one of the challenges we have as doctors is working out who's just got a bit of fatty liver and it's never going to be a problem versus who's actually on that pathway towards developing scarring and cirrhosis and complications thereof.
You mentioned that some people who have these fatty deposits might have changes on their liver function tests when they have a blood test done. We've spoken a bit about liver function tests on the show over the year. Does everybody with fatty accumulation have changes that are visible on the blood tests, or could you have it and have a completely normal result with your GP when you have your liver checked?
You can have a completely normal result, and you can actually even have cirrhosis and have completely normal liver blood tests. And this is why we're asking GPs as part of our national guidance that's just been rolled out to just be aware of the risk factors. They are people with type 2 diabetes, people who are overweight, people with abnormal cholesterol and other fats in the blood. And think about, could this patient have fatty liver disease? And the best way of looking for that would be with an ultrasound scan, because we can see the texture of the liver changes if it's got fatty infiltration.
So even if someone has a normal blood result, you've gone and got your results back, but if you're at high risk, you've got diabetes, potentially living with overweight obesity, then you might need that next step of an ultrasound.
Absolutely. And if you have the ultrasound and it confirms there's fat in the liver, then your GP can do a very simple test just on the blood test you've already had done, a little algorithm or a formula to calculate whether you're at risk of having fibrosis or scarring in the liver.
And then there's the option for more scanning, isn't there, James? A thing called a FibroScan, which can look at the stretchiness or elasticity of the liver and give a bit of a better picture. What kinds of people are needing that further step in investigation?
So in the fatty liver space, what we're saying to GPs is if you can't rule out that somebody might have scarring based on that simple algorithmic blood test, which we call a Fib4 test, which is essentially can be calculated just on your normal bloods, then we're asking the GPs to refer people in for a FibroScan. And FibroScan's a really cool gadget. It's been around for a few years now. It was originally designed to test whether cheese was ripe in the middle, you know, in France.
Yeah, delicious.
So, Yeah, so you know, you had the big wheels of cheese and you wanted to work out whether it was ripe in the middle, but you didn't want to stick a big skewer into it. So it was invented to do that. But then somebody realized that that'd be a good way to look at whether the liver is also stiff or soft in the middle. And because, of course, as you lay down scar tissue, your liver gets harder. And that's what the machine, the FibroScan, measures. It measures the stiffness or the hardness of the liver. And it's really, really reliable. It's repeatable. It doesn't hurt and it's quick to do. So we think it's a great test.
Do people have symptoms with fatty liver, or could people be roaming around and have absolutely no idea that they've got it?
The vast majority, and this is the worry, the vast majority are completely asymptomatic and will often only develop symptoms when it's really advanced. Some people might have a degree of pain in the right upper side of their abdomen, but for by and large, it's usually asymptomatic until it's quite advanced.
What can you do about it, James? There often tends to be a lot of talk about prevention. People talk about preventing fatty liver, eat lots of fruit and veggies, move the body, weight management. What if you get the diagnosis? What are the options for actually treating it?
So the mainstay of treatment is, as you say, is lifestyle change. It's weight loss and it's exercise, and we recommend 150 minutes of exercise a week. Weight loss, we know, is really difficult. I mean, sometimes even just changing your diet for healthier options, even if it doesn't lead to a degree of weight loss, can be actually healthy for the diet. For instance, replacing the fats in your diet with olive oil, for instance. Olive oil is rich in polyphenols, which are anti-inflammatory. That can be a really good change. If people are thinking about changing their diet, I would point them towards the website of the Liver Foundation. They have got an absolutely superb section on healthy eating for liver disease that is much better than a lot of the other information out there, because actually they produce recipes that are culturally appropriate. So there's recipes that are high in protein, low in fat, and healthy for your liver for the Thai community, Indian community, Chinese community, and Western Australian community. So it's actually really, really a useful website, and there's lots of information on there.
And what about medication options? So the lifestyle, as you said, is really important, but what if that's not enough?
Well, we realised that, you know, doctors were very good at telling people to lose weight and exercise. And the reality, the way we live our life, we're very busy. It's a struggle to find all that time to exercise. It's a struggle to always make those healthy options. And of course, when cost of living is difficult, eating healthily can sometimes be more expensive. So it is difficult. We recognise that. And because it's such a problem, there are now a whole bunch of medications that are coming through which are designed to help with fatty liver. There is unfortunately nothing licensed for fatty liver on the PBS in Australia at the moment, but we hope that will change soon. A drug called resmetirom is available in the US for treatment of fatty liver. And of course, we all know about the weight loss agents like Wegovy and Mounjaro. And these can be very helpful both for weight loss and have been shown to improve fatty liver in terms of reducing inflammation and scarring. But they're not available for that indication at the moment in Australia.
So you're talking about those GLP-1 medications that are often being talked about for weight management might actually help in fatty liver as well.
Yeah, and interestingly, some of the changes, the improvements in fatty liver appear to be independent of actually losing weight. So there might be something about modulation of inflammation in the body that's helpful.
And you said that before, that even some dietary interventions and tweaking some things in the diet, even without a shift in weight, may yield benefit.
Absolutely. I would recommend anybody who knows they've got fatty liver disease should probably be drinking 2 to 3 cups of coffee a day.
Oh.
Has to be good coffee.
And yeah. Why is that? Tell us why. But we want to hear about it. Coffee's good for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's rich in antioxidants and, again, these plant polyphenols, which have this magical effect on soothing inflammation in the liver. So it's the one good thing I can tell patients in the clinic. Say, when I ask them if they drink coffee and they sort of grudgingly say, yeah, I do. I say, well, that's great. Carry on. Because all the evidence from big population studies show that your risk of fibrosis progression if you drink coffee is reduced. That's not the same as saying if you've got fatty liver and you don't drink coffee and you start drinking coffee, it's going to make an impact. But certainly coffee doesn't appear to be a bad thing.
If you've got fatty liver, James, I'm assuming you need extra surveillance, ongoing monitoring. Are these people who should be seeing their GP regularly? They might see a liver specialist or a gastroenterologist as well?
Yeah, so in the national guidelines that were released last year, we focus on a number of things. One is the fibrosis assessment or the scarring assessment, and those people who haven't got scarring in their liver based on their FIB4 test can remain safely in primary care, but they still need monitoring. So don't forget that a fatty liver is an expression of a disordered metabolism, and that can lead not only to fatty liver, but can also lead to an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, an increased risk of some cancers. So people do need monitoring and do need advice. If patients are deemed to have more fibrosis and are at risk, then these are patients who will be seen in a secondary care setting, either in a gastroenterology clinic or a hepatology clinic. And these are people who will have more investigations, closer surveillance, and may actually be invited to take part in clinical trials and other interventions to help.
That's Professor James O'Byrne, who's a consultant hepatologist at Sunshine Coast University Hospital in Queensland.
And the good news is that there's something we can do even if we don't know we've got fatty liver disease.
Yes. All the stuff that you love banging on about, if you will, Norman. Mm-hmm. Mediterranean diet and physical activity, all the simple but really good stuff that's not always easy to achieve.
You're with the Health Report on ABC Radio National.
Coming up later in the show, new research showing that Indigenous infants are born with a really diverse gut microbiome. What does it mean, and does it potentially mean a healthier early start in life?
And it's got messages for us all in there.
Mm.
But let's go to some good news with a little bit of a twist in the tail. The fifth report has just come out on cervical cancer rates and the benefits of the screening program into cervical cancer in Australia. It's changed. We're looking for the human papillomavirus, and women get screened every 5 years rather than every 2 years. And they're aiming for elimination, I think, by 2035. That's what they're trying to do here, because they think that by the process of screening and immunisation of young people, boys and girls, because boys spread it to girls and boys get HPV cancers themselves, is that the combination of that with the screening, you could eliminate it. So there have been no cases reported in women under the age of 25, which is the first time since records began that that's been noted. Here's Julia Brotherton, who's Professor of Cancer Prevention Policy and Implementation at the University of Melbourne.
We have two amazing tools to prevent this cancer from occurring. The first is HPV vaccination. Now that we know that almost always this cancer is caused by infection with HPV or human papillomavirus. And the second is screening. So we've used pap tests in the past, I'm sure everyone's familiar with that particular experience. If you're a woman, it's not particularly pleasant. But now we have what's called HPV-based screening. It means that we're actually looking for the virus itself. It's a lot more accurate. You need it less frequency. So it's a real game changer. So the combination of vaccinating all our kids against this cancer-causing virus, and then for those of us who are too old to have been vaccinated, having that screening means that it's in reach to actually get rid of this cancer.
And the basis of that screening, which is now once every 5 years, is that assuming that you haven't got HPV, but if you have got HPV, then you are on alert and you're monitored to see whether you get rid of it or not, and whether it changes the cells in your cervix, and then you intervene accordingly.
Yeah, exactly right. So for over 90% of people who have this screen, it'll be completely fine. They'll be reassured they can safely go away for 5 years and not really have to think about it. If you do have an HPV detected, the test is actually looking for the types of HPV that can, if they stay persistently in your cervix for a very long time, eventually result in cancer. The good news is that normally does take a long time, and it gives us time to check the cells there, make sure they're healthy. If we do see any cell changes, that's when you'll be referred to a specialist to have a closer look and have some treatment of those cells if necessary. And the great thing is, you know, this test, well, we call it cancer screening, but it's really preventing cancer. It's trying to find those precancerous lesions so that no woman ever has to face the diagnosis of cervical cancer.
So this progress report, on the surface, looks like good news. Give us the good news before we get on to the caveats.
Australia has a national cervical cancer elimination plan, and we've developed some indicators to track how we're proceeding. And you're right, there is good news. We're actually starting to see perhaps the indication that our cervical cancer rate is starting to go down as we actually head towards elimination. And it is a bit of a race. I believe the Swedes are in hot contention to get there before us. And women are actually starting to really engage, I think, a lot more in the new cervical cycle screening options. So the other thing we haven't mentioned is that HPV screening allows women and people with a cervix to actually take their own test. And that just means that a simple vaginal swab that you can take yourself or with support from your nurse or doctor if you need it, is just as good at finding that HPV DNA that's the basis of the test.
And there have been no cervical cancer cases diagnosed in the moon under 25. And that's the first time you noticed that since 1982. Were there ever very many of women under 25 getting cervical cancer?
No, I'm pleased to say there were never a lot. Unfortunately, there have always been a small handful of people who, for whatever reason, and it's usually those very aggressive HPV types that are now covered by the vaccine, that in the past may develop earlier cancers. And this is the first time, as you mentioned, since we've had national records that we've seen no cases.
So not only are you finding less cervical cancer, you're finding less human papillomavirus as well.
Oh, absolutely. So before we had our vaccine program, used to see these massive peaks of HPV infection in young women.
And of course, they catch the HPV from their partner, who's usually male. And you've been immunizing boys as well. And one of the fastest rising cancers in males in Australia, particularly white males, has been pharyngeal cancer, which is an HPV cancer. And there's also anal cancer as well. So presumably, although we're not screening men, those rates should be starting to go down as well.
Oh, look, we're really waiting to see that turnaround. So I really urge parents and young men who are 25 or younger who can still access that free single dose of HPV vaccine to go and get vaccinated. It really is going to be your best protection against these head and neck cancers. And as you said, anal cancer is particularly nasty cancer. Luckily, it is still rare, but it's such an amazing opportunity to just be able to prevent those cancers from occurring in the first place.
So, Julia, whilst your boundless enthusiasm is fantastic, there is a little dark side to this report, which is immunisation rates are falling, and they're falling greater in boys than in girls, and screening rates are dropping, and there's a huge disparity between non-Indigenous Australia and First Nations people.
Yeah, that is the dark side of this report, as you say. We really can't drop the ball. You know, we've had such a fantastic school-based immunisation program for so long, and then we had COVID. And I really think there's so much happening in that space. You know, schools are under the greatest pressure they've ever been, you know, with teacher numbers.
Are we not doing the school-based program anymore?
No, we certainly are. But the issue really is that we always assumed that it was quite straightforward to vaccinate 12 to 13-year-olds at school because they would be in school. We now have the poorest school attendance and highest absenteeism rates we've ever seen, and they're not improving. We've got a sector that's under immense pressure. So the idea that you can simply go in and line up the kids and give them vaccines is a lot more challenging than it used to be in the past. And we've spoken to immunisation teams across the country, and they're really feeling that it's a real challenge in this space now. And so I think we need to start thinking a bit more laterally. I think if we can't always capture young people in schools, if parents are just too busy and don't understand the consent form or can't do the digital online consent and all those things, people need to just know that they can always go and get their single HPV vaccine dose from their GP, from their community health centre, from their pharmacist. Whatever way is convenient for you is the right way. If you've got a year seven this year, look out for that, you know, next year, look out for the consent form. If you've got a child who, for whatever reason, wasn't at school that day, make sure that they've had their HPV vaccine. It's really important for their future health.
And in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, first of all, Aboriginal women are getting cervical cancer at a higher rate than non-Aboriginal women, and their survival rate is significantly lower.
I think it's a real black mark against all of us. You know, we've had cervical screening programs in place since 1991. And sure, that gap has come down a little bit, but our programs just have not been meeting the needs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women. And I think, you know, we're also concerned that school-based immunisation programs are missing a lot of our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids as well. So again, I think we need to think laterally. We need to really embrace the whole self-collection option for cervical screening. We're seeing more tests that are given with self-collection. It's almost half of them now across the country. And the absolute highest uptake we're seeing is in people who live in very remote areas, people in the Northern Territory, people in the lowest socioeconomic groups, and amongst older women.
So it's part of the problem with the lower screening rate, the fact that it's gone from annually to every 5 years, and women just simply forget.
No, I actually think it's the other way around. So previously we were asking people to come in every 2 years their cervical screening
test. I'm having to do it myself. It wasn't sort of
not
seared
top of mind.
In my brain. Right?
Yeah, no, but, you know, and that's really hard. If you ask most women, they'd say, oh, I never get around to doing it every 2 years. I mean.
So how do women remember? Do they get a recall?
Yeah, so we now have a single national register. And for the first time now, we actually invite people. We let them know before they're due. If people have never engaged in screening, it's still got to be from someone trusted in their community, whether that's their GP or their Aboriginal healthcare worker or their mum or their auntie who's had a positive screening experience. It's probably going to make the difference.
And how aware are young people of the vaccine, do you think?
Unfortunately, a lot of young people don't know that as of 2023, they can go and get themselves a single free HPV vaccine dose and that's all they need. You know, the evidence has moved on from when we started. We were giving three doses to everyone in the school program. It was really hard to get three doses, but now it's just a single dose. So you can talk to your GP, you can go to your pharmacist and get that dose. And it doesn't matter what the reason you missed out was, if you weren't at school that day, if your mum and dad didn't want you to get the vaccine, or if you weren't even in the country, you can now rock up and get your vaccine and give yourself the best protection against not only cervical cancer, but the other HPV-related cancers as well.
Julia Brotherton, who's Professor of Cancer Prevention, Policy and Implementation at the University of Melbourne.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
Really interesting research in one of the Nature journals this week from Australia, looking at the microbiome of First Nations babies, First Nations infants, and comparing them to infants, non-Indigenous infants, in urban settings in Australia, and an amazing insight into these children who are growing up in fairly remote locations, and they got a real surprise from the findings. And you and I spoke to the lead researcher on the paper, Professor Len Harrison of the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute for Medical Research and the University of Melbourne.
I propose that we look at the gut microbiome of Indigenous infants as an indicator of their health and also as a baseline foundation really for understanding why they might later on develop chronic non-communicable diseases like diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, kidney disease, all of which they're at much higher risk for than non-Indigenous individuals.
What did you find, Len, when it came to the gut microbiome of these Indigenous infants that you tested? What did you find compared to their non-Indigenous counterparts?
Yeah, so we compared the gut microbiomes of Indigenous infants here living remotely in northeast Arnhem Land with the gut microbiomes of age and sex-matched non-Indigenous infants living in urban Australia. And we found that, to our surprise, frankly, that the Indigenous infants had a much richer and more diverse gut microbiome than the non-Indigenous infants. Even though they're still exposed to a remote environment and some traditional foods, they do have access to Western diet, and we didn't think that the differences would be so striking.
We look at the differences. I'm sorry to get down into the weeds. You showed a greater alpha diversity. Now, that's a measure of gut health. You know, when you've got greater alpha diversity, your immune system is set lower, you've got less inflammation going on in the body. I mean, it looked like good news for the health of these infants, the pattern that you found.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, it is good news. It's a really good news story. It means that they start life with a healthy gut microbiome and that it hasn't been transmitted intergenerationally to them. If they develop the sort of gut microbiome that urban people or children have as they consume a Western diet, if they do, it'll be acquired later on. And I guess one of the corollaries of all this is to now make sure that we try and institute some sort of programs that might avert that from happening.
Why is it that these children are at higher risk of chronic diseases? Is it that we think that the gut microbiome changes with westernisation, or are there other factors?
We don't know the answer yet, but my proposal would be that, yes, they start life with a very healthy-looking gut microbiome, but they're then subjected eventually to the dangers of a Western diet. They succumb to that, and that changes the whole picture. Now, in addition to that, I think that they are more highly susceptible to these changes, these Western diet-induced changes, than probably non-Indigenous populations, because I suspect that they have evolved to have very strong immune responses to infection. The trade-off for that is that when they then have a Western diet that's high in fat, in particular, which is gobbled up by immune cells called macrophages, they make inflammation, which then go on to promote these chronic cardiometabolic disorders.
Len, I just wondered, you mentioned before that you collaborated with Indigenous elders from the community and there are also Indigenous authors on the study. Was there a reason that this particular community was chosen for the study? Was there something about the diet or the remoteness or the geography?
Well, there was something about the remoteness. The diet we sort of had to evaluate. But I think it was really driven by the willingness of the community to participate in such studies. And I don't take any responsibility for making it happen. I mean, that was my colleague, Professor Beverly Biggs from the Doherty Institute, who started this fieldwork for this study.
So how does this information translate into the real world? What kinds of things can actually be done?
Yeah, well, the first thing that we need to do is to go back to the local community and explain to them what the microbiome is and how important it is to health and so on. But then we need to emphasize the importance of keeping it that way and how it is kept that way by avoiding the types of components of a Western diet that we know are not healthy.
But if you were to say that to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community, particularly a remote one, they'd say, well, you can bang on all you like about that, Professor Harrison, but we kind of know what to do, but we can't buy it. And if we could buy it, we can't afford it.
Yeah, well, we need to use this sort of information to convince, you know, the authorities that we need to subsidise healthy foods in that environment, as well as us educating the community about healthy eating. That's not an easy task. I mean, it's much easier to measure the microbiome than it is to change people's behaviour, including non-Indigenous people.
How much of this is genes? Increasingly, it's being realised that it's not just your diet that defines your microbiome, it's actually the genes that you carry as well. So how much of this do you believe is the fact that these kids are the children of their parents and the parent, you know, for generations, if not thousands of years, they've carried the genes that predispose to this microbiome?
I don't believe that your genome determines the majority of your microbiome. I think we get a core microbiome at birth, which we hang on to, but around that core microbiome, you know, you can change things dramatically with diet, with a whole lot of environmental factors, including ones that are hard to measure, like, you know, social stress, which is an issue in these communities as well. So we can change things, and we don't have to change things with this lot. We just have to keep it the way it is, because it's 114 species different between Indigenous and non-Indigenous children, thousands more bacteria, viruses and fungi compared to the non-Indigenous children. I mean, that is partly due to the genetics, but it's also, I think, a reflection of the remote environment and the traditional diet.
Just finally, Len, to what extent is this a window into history, that a window that might be disappearing? In other words, we can see what things would have been like in times gone by.
Absolutely, Norman. The bacteria that are almost exclusive to the Australian Indigenous infants have vanished from the non-Indigenous infant population. We don't see them, and we know that some of them are actually quite critical for good health. So we're seeing a snapshot of history as it was in the pre-industrial time.
And that was the study lead, Professor Len Harrison from the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute for Medical Research and the University of Melbourne.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
So what's in the mailbag?
We've got a couple of great emails this week. We've got Sean, who's written in saying, I want to share my vitamin B6 toxicity experience briefly, and that is because we've been talking about it in the news with the TGA changing.
Eventually.
In June 2027. That really got your goat, didn't it, Norman?
By the year 2100, they'll do something about it. Yeah,
it got Norman's goat, everyone. But yes, they've changed how you can access it. Well, that's going to come into effect, so it's not as accessible in different doses. You'll need to speak to a pharmacist. But Sean says, I take a magnesium supplement for cramps mostly. I was told zinc was needed as well. After 3 months of taking zinc daily with 28 milligrams per tablet of B6, I experienced fingertip tingling, which progressed to the same on both feet. I saw the report on 7:30 on B6 and stopped the zinc immediately. After just 3 months of B6 overdose and a year after cessation, the nerve disruption has subsided only marginally and it persists today.
Oh dear.
I now know even 28 milligrams daily of B6 on top of a good diet is an overdose with apparently permanent ramifications. It seems the TGA has bowed to commercial pressure in delaying B6 restrictions.
I'm on your side, Sean. It's ridiculous.
That's a very interesting story. I think we should also remember that this can happen at much lower doses than what people think, as Sean has just demonstrated. So you don't really need a supplement unless you're deficient or...
That's the irony, is that you don't need it. The trouble is you don't have a choice. If you're deciding you're going to take a supplement, sometimes the B6 is there, and if you're wanting that supplement, you've got to take the B6.
But with it.
I think you and I would both say, throw it in the bucket and don't buy it.
Yes, unless you're preconception planning a pregnancy or you're deficient, there's always asterisks to that. Fiona has also written in, I was listening to the episode Re Women in Health and I thought I might share our story with you.
We should explain. I mean, this is the story on pain and women being recognised.
Yes, the Victorian Health Inquiry into Women's Pain, which we covered last week. So Fiona says, our 18-year-old granddaughter presented to the ED in the central west of New South Wales with sudden onset of headache, not previously having suffered with headaches. She was sent home with Panadol, a pat on the hand for women's problems. She then re-presented...
So you thought it was menstrual?
Well, I think, or possibly just not fully investigated is perhaps the suggestion. She then re-presented to the same facility with aphasia and was again sent home with the diagnosis of women's problems. Yes, you're right, menstrual.
So the fact that you can't speak, which is what aphasia is, I mean, this is mind-boggling.
That's not menstrual, friends. Of course, there are limited doctors and trying to get appointments is a nightmare. She did see a doctor in another town, 1.25 hours from home, had an MRI and was flown to Sydney with a brain tumour and operated within 4 days. She has since had radiotherapy and chemo at the Lifehouse. She has ceased active treatment and it's a wait and see game now. We are so sorry to hear that, Fiona. But that is a classic example of where women can actually be dismissed in the healthcare system and their problems attributed to hormonal stuff when it's just not that.
So we've got one from Alyssa as well.
Yes, who says, I work in a publicly funded sexual health clinic in New South Wales.
Oh, so this is on the same topic.
Yes, because from the Victorian Pain Inquiry, there was the announcement of the green whistles coming into some hubs for an insertion of an intrauterine device. So that's what Elisa's referring to. We wanted to offer Penthrox whistles to our patients undergoing IUD insertion, but hit a wall with regard to ventilation. Turns out there are a lot of guidelines around how many whistles can be used in an enclosed space and subsequent staff exposure to the medication.
Oh, so you might get high. That's a theory.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
So she says a pregnant staff member should not be in the room when a patient is using the whistle. I didn't know that. I'm sure that I've been in a room. Okay. We decided this was an unacceptable HR issue because we can't be asking staff to disclose early pregnancies. We really wanted to be able to use the whistles, but it was an administrative nightmare. I would love to know how ambulance officers, for example, get around this. They are using them in a very confined space. I'd certainly be watching the Vic whistle trial for IUDs closely.
Good point. And we might have a look at this in the new year.
And please write into us also if there's anyone who goes, oh, this is what we do. But you do have to declare it with radiation. Because I remember being in many theatres and people would go, I can't be in the room for the whatever Will calls it when he flicks the machine for an X-ray, the little portable one.
It's called the switch.
But you have to declare it early for that. So anyway, I'm not sure what the way around is. If you want to write in and tell us or you want to add other thoughts, you have questions, comments, topics for us next year, our address is healthreport@abc.net.au.
Don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash, where this week we're looking at creatine. Does it have uses beyond muscle? Are there any risks? You can find that out. Meantime, Priya, I'll see you next week when you'll be a year older.
I will be a year older. And wiser, potentially, too, Norman.
Yes. How could you be even wiser than you are? I just don't know.
Oh, he's being nice to me, everybody. Luckily, this is on tape. I'll see you next week, Norman.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.